Talking History with Patrick Gagan. This is News Talk.
We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender.
And out of that silence came thousands of voices.
The strategy of the white man has always been divide and conquer.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Auchtereuen, Argus.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, we're finding out how a self-proclaimed Siberian monk rose from obscurity to take a place at the heart of Russian imperial power. And we'll be debating whether Rasputin was a healer, a charlatan, a political force, or simply a myth made flesh. You can send us your thoughts and comments to talkinghistory@newstalk.com, and we'd love to hear from you. Tonight's show is on Rasputin. Gregory Rasputin, the so-called mad monk, rose from obscurity to become the most controversial figure at the court of Tsar Nicholas II. Rasputin never held office and never commanded troops, but his presence at court and the scandalous rumours that surrounded him eroded confidence in a monarchy already weakened by war, unrest and fear. Over time, his name became shorthand for decay at the heart of the regime. Murdered by a group of Russian nobles in December 1916, Rasputin's legend lived on, shaping perceptions and fueling conspiracies, and his story provides a revealing insight into the role of myth, personality and belief in the making and unmaking of power. And so in tonight's show, we're debating the life and legacy of the man whose shadow seemed to fall across the final years of Imperial Russia. And to help me do this, I'm delighted to welcome two wonderful historians. In the first part of the show, I'll be talking to Sir Anthony Beaver, the acclaimed writer and historian, whose books include the award-winning Stalingrad, as well as Russia, Revolution and Civil War, and most recently, Rasputin and the Downfall of the Romanovs, published in paperback by Weidenfeld and Nicholson. And later in the show, I'll be talking to Dr. Helen Rappaport, the internationally best-selling author, media consultant and historian who specialises in British and Russian history from 1837 to 1918. And her books include Ekaterinburg, The Last Days of the Romanovs, as well as Caught in the Revolution, Petrograd, Russia, 1917, A World on the Edge, and most recently, The Race to Save the Romanovs, The Truth Behind the Secret Plans to Rescue the Russian Imperial Family. And we're delighted to begin tonight's show with Anthony Beaver to talk about his new book. And it's been described as one of the great stories of history told by one of our greatest historians. So to talk to us about this story, Anthony, why do you think the story of Rasputin captures the public imagination and captures the imagination of historians?
It's a very important and but also unique story. We've never seen one character, and here it's, shall we say, the opposite to the great man theory of history. We see a semi-literate Siberian peasant who has more effect on the course of history than almost any individual. Now, that may sound an exaggeration, but one has to remember how Alexander Kerensky, who was the head of the provisional government after the February 1917 revolution, he said quite openly, he said, without Rasputin, there would have been no Lenin. So the knock-on effect on history was absolutely huge. It was really the way that sort of Rasputin's totally innocent, but actually, his great friendship with the Empress because of the way that he was able to help calm the hemophiliac son, gave the impression that he was having an affair with the Empress herself. And this made the Tsar appear a weak cuckold. So when it came to the popular revolution of February 1917, there were was no sword drawn by the officers of the Imperial Life Guard regiments in defense of the regime. This led, therefore, to the Russian Revolution and then to the communist dictatorship.
And do you think he was a symbol of a collapsing system? Was he a catalyst who speeded up what was happening? Or did he play a crucial role in the public and even the aristocracy losing confidence in the Tsar and in the monarchy?
Well, both really. I mean, though, of course, there was a sort of certain cumulative effect. The war against Japan in 1905, which was utterly disastrous and entirely the fault of the Tsar himself, of Nicholas II. But then also that didn't necessarily mean that revolution was inevitable. But there were, as I say, accumulation of events and misjudgments by the Tsar. But it was the fake news of the period, this, the idea that somehow, you know, the Tsar was a cuckold, as I was saying, and that Rasputin was sleeping with the Empress and her daughters. I mean, this was sort of the, as the revolution approached, or if you like, as the situation became worse, there was these sort of pornographic fantasies, rather like just the time of the French Revolution. Of course, you know, these grotesque stories started to circulate.
But it is interesting that Rasputin played a role in contributing to the myths and to the legends, because you explore so brilliantly how he did have these relationships with women. He had all these female followers. There was a spiritual dimension, but there was also a physical dimension that he enabled some of these myths to grow. And because his behavior was sometimes so unacceptable.
Absolutely. No, you're quite right. I mean, this was the problem. I mean, he was creating scandals on a frequent basis, partly by drunkenness, but above all also by his seductions, which in fact often involve blackmail and even outright rape. I mean, he was an extraordinary mixture of the two. And actually, the way I'm intrigued so much by his character is it involves every single contradiction you could imagine. I mean, he was basically deeply spiritual, but utterly lascivious. He could hardly control himself in many ways. And he could switch from one to the other almost in a matter of seconds, as many of the women or other people who observed him closely noted at the time. He basically was incredibly corrupt in the way that he accepted money. He was involved in contracts for supplying the underwear to the Russian army in the First World War, and yet gave all the money away. So we see this sort of mixture, as I say, of corruption and cupidity, and but also of generosity. And it is these contradictions, this way that, for example, the great poet Tchurchev said in the 19th century, Russia can only be cannot be understood with the mind alone. One sees these contradictions really in the whole of the Russian character, if one can talk about a sort of national character. I mean, of course, there's no DNA for any nation, but at the same time in Russia, one sees this mixture of European and Asian. One sees this sort of Western Slavophile split. And one even sees it right today, the way that, you know, Putin may talk about the collapse of the Soviet Union as the greatest tragedy of the 20th century. And yet at the same time, Putin is obsessed with the tradition of the Russian Empire. I mean, there aren't any hammers and sickles in the Kremlin. It's all double-headed gold eagles. So, I mean, one's seeing this confusion. And Rasputin was sort of very much part of it.
You begin one of the chapters with an extraordinary story of bad behavior, and it was a report that was sent to the Tsar in 1915, and it created a huge scandal. Rasputin misbehaving at a restaurant, chatting up the women singers, telling them that the outfit he was wearing had been a gift from the Empress, and then I suppose flashing them, you know, just behaving really badly. But as you showed, this was a complete myth or a lie or propaganda developed by his enemies to destroy him.
Yes, it's absolutely right. And I mean, there were cases of that. In some examples, it's very hard to know whether they were true or not. And you know, one can give him that if necessary the benefit of the doubt. But there is no doubt that the way that he comported himself, but above all the way that he behaved with women, was outrageous. It was also deeply hypocritical, because Rasputin would sort of, in many ways, pretend to be, you know, the voice of the peasantry at the imperial court. And yet at the same time, when it came to the seduction of women, he treated poor, vulnerable women who were desperate to try to get their husband or their son out of military service during the First World War. He would sort of either threaten, cajole, or blackmail them so that he could have his way in. So this was for somebody who was convinced that he understood women better than anybody and loved women. But at the, as I say, at the same time, he did behave monstrously with a number of them.
I think a huge part of his legend and the reason why he is so remembered and you see him popping up in movies and television programs and dramas and books is, I think, the circumstances surrounding his eventual death. He survived one assassination attempt, but then the way he was killed in December 1916, I think, is such an important part of his legend. I think if he had died of old age, or if a single bullet had killed him, or if the poison had worked, there wouldn't be the same mythology around him.
Well, the whole extraordinary story of his death, his murder assassination, you know, here was somebody who was actually a loyal monarchist, but because of the disastrous effect that he was having on the monarchy, on the Romanov dynasty, meant that actually members of his family, there was, of course, Prince Yusupov, who was married to the Tsar's favorite niece, the beautiful Grand Duchess Irena, but also the Tsar's favorite nephew, who Prince Dmitry Pavlovich, later, funnily enough, the lover of Coco Chanel. But I mean, he was part of the assassination team, along with a notorious politician who was the leader of the Black Hundreds, who the anti-Semitic groups. All of them, these were extreme right-wingers who were loyal to the monarchy, and yet there they were killing the person who, as far as the empress was concerned, was the one person who could actually save the dynasty because of his ability to reduce the suffering of her son and heir, the Tsarevich. So, I mean, you know, there was every paradox imaginable there. And the whole story of the assassination, I mean, was unbelievably incompetent. I mean, in a way, one of the chapters is actually called Russian Farce. I mean, there's a sort of an element of Clouseau, of Inspector Clouseau, almost, in their inability to get themselves together. And the fact of this was supposed to be secret, and yet they would tell journalists beforehand. It was almost unbelievable. But anyway, in the end, they did kill him in this sort of ambush in this palace in St. Petersburg. And the Tsar simply had to work out what to do, how to punish them, because he knew that they'd become national heroes by killing Rasputin.
And let's go back in time then to maybe how he rose to prominence. And we sometimes talk about someone being the right person in the right place at the right time. He seems to have been the wrong person in the wrong place at the wrong time, because he was able to build this relationship with the Tsar and his wife at a time when Russia was humiliated after the war with Japan. The country was... The monarchy seems to be in the state of dependency and insecurity, and it was a time when the country itself was feeling insecure, and he seems to have arrived at a crucial moment in the Tsar's personal history, but also in the history of Russia.
Indeed, but I mean, from his point of view, in a way, it was a perfect moment, because the Tsar, as you rightly described, was feeling very vulnerable after those disasters. But that did not necessarily mean that, although I was talking about the cumulative effect, that did not mean that revolution was inevitable. Because in fact, what we see is the way that just before the First World War, the economy is about to take off in a big way. But at that moment in 1905, when Rasputin arrives and is introduced to the Tsar, he is seen certainly by the Empress as a key figure, because also she has this need, in a way, to have a sort of guru figure. There had been one before called Philippe, who was a French charlatan, who even had presented a bell to the Empress saying that, you know, as soon as anybody hostile comes, this bell will ring. And he gave her some flowers, which he persuaded her had been touched by Jesus Christ. I mean, it's quite extraordinary, quite how naive and easy she was to be persuaded of Rasputin's saintliness. But the moment he actually performed supposedly this miracle, particularly in 1911, when it seemed that the Tsarevich was on the point of death, from then on, of course, nobody could touch him, because she saw him as a saint. The Tsar, too, was sort of obviously deeply impressed, but I think slightly less than his wife. But she was determined that, you know, nobody could criticize him in any way at all. And that was what gave him his unparalleled power and influence, to the point of actually, when the war started and the Tsar moved as commander-in-chief to the general headquarters, to the Slavka, they were able to appoint the ministers, even the prime ministers, in a chaotic way, which was referred to as a ministerial leapfrog, as in despair, the newspapers would sort of describe what was going on. And this was absolutely chaotic and totally disastrous for the country.
And indeed, as the war went so badly wrong for Russia, you also explore how military failure destroys the idea of the monarchy being sacred and the Tsar being this untouchable figure, because it does undermine confidence. And then Rasputin is there also undermining what's seen as the legitimacy of the monarchy.
Well, indeed. And the previous commander-in-chief, who had been the Tsar's cousin, the Grand Duke Nikolasha, was regarded as a threat by Rasputin and by the Empress, because they seemed to believe that he wanted the throne for himself. And that's why they urged the Tsar to take over the supreme command himself. But the ministers and even the allies, the British and the French, their ambassadors and the officers attached to the general headquarters, were all trying to persuade the Tsar not to take over the supreme command, because they knew perfectly well that any of the disasters which were happening, and in 1915, it was this disastrous retreat all the way across Poland, right into Belarus, they knew that the Tsar would be blamed for all of these disasters. And of course he was. And that sort of contributed even more to the whole impression of collapse and of chaos.
And of course, at a time then during the First World War, they first of all try to remove Rasputin, and his legend just seems to grow, and he becomes in a way a national scapegoat as well for these failures and for these humiliations and defeats.
Well, you would say scapegoat, that would imply that he was being unfairly blamed, but he was genuinely responsible. I mean, when it came to the last major appointment, when they appointed this character called Protopopov to become the Minister of the Interior, which was even sort of almost more important than the position of Prime Minister, Protopopov was actually suffering from syphilis. He believed that he could commune with the dead. And this character then appointed himself as being in charge of all the railways. And this was actually what led to the disaster in the winter of 1916, when the railways were frozen up and he had got total chaos on the railways, which were vital for bringing the food to the cities. And so when Although there was plenty of food, there was plenty of grain at this particular time. It just was in the wrong places, and because of the hard winter frosts and so forth, they weren't able to get them to the cities in time. And this is what actually then triggered, just after Rasputin's death, triggered the uprising of February 1917.
How do you view Rasputin? Do you think he was a fraud or was he a healer? He seems, some believe that he had this kind of magnetic power in his hands, and some believe that perhaps there was some spiritual force there that gave belief or confidence to those who he was helping. But then to others, he was a complete charlatan. So I wonder, how do you view him?
Well, in a way, both. He was both. I mean, this is the thing, as I was saying, that he was capable of one thing and the other, of opposites within his own character. And, you know, they were both there living side by side with switching from one to another. So there were aspects of him which were absolutely genuine. I mean, his spiritualism and sort of deeply felt emotional love of God and the world, the natural world, and all the rest of it was quite genuine. But at the same time, he was a fraud in other ways. And actually, to be a successful fraud, you have got to believe totally in what you're saying. So, you know, does that actually make you a fraud as well at the same time? It's an almost impossible one, but it's also what makes him so fascinating, and also, again, as I was saying, what seems to be such a reflection of these, when one talks of the double-headed eagle as a symbol of Imperial Russia, there it is. There is this sort of split personality, which is sort of summed up in that particular symbol.
Your book also brilliantly shows how powerful a rumour can be in politics and how willing people can be to believe these stories, and it shapes how the elite and the aristocracy views what's happening and how it's seen by the public. But it takes over from what the reality is, and all kinds of different rumours and half-truths and sometimes untruths are believed, and it really shapes what happens in Russia.
Well, I think it's terribly important to realize that actually historians in the past have totally underestimated the power of rumor. I mean, the official version of history has always been based on official documents, which never take into account the power of rumor. And we are living in an age, and, you know, in fact, there have been many ages, and one's seen how fake news, fake truth, whatever you want to call it, has always existed in the past as well. Whether it was with the French Revolution, I mean, there's the sort of the pornographic fantasies which were believed at the time by the population. Similarly, one finds these with just before the Russian Revolution as well. And just because these rumors were completely untrue doesn't mean they didn't have an effect. They had a huge effect. And in fact, were almost more powerful than the truth itself. So this is where one has to sort of see, and one's seeing it today. Let's face it, you know, we're seeing in the United States the whole power of fake news, of fake truth and all the rest of it. Which people will believe even when the evidence against it is often so powerful.
Do you think the Russian monarchy was doomed in 1914 when the war started? Was it doomed in December 1916 when Rasputin was eventually killed? Or was there still a chance for Nicholas to turn things around in 1917?
Oh, no, that was far too late. And even the killing of Rasputin was far too late to have any effect. You know, if Rasputin had been killed when he was stabbed in the summer of 1914, and that, of course, is has sometimes been argued as one of the what ifs of history, because, you know, people say, would Rasputin have been able to persuade the Tsar not to enter the war? Because Rasputin, actually, one of the things he was certainly right about was that this would be absolutely disastrous for the regime. But the Tsar, I don't think, would have listened anyway, even if Rasputin had not been stabbed by this woman. the Tsar would have would certainly have ignored that, because he would not accept any advice, if you like, on the military side. But that was going to be, if you like, the biggest disaster, the very entry of Russia into the war, because Rasputin certainly got that one right about the danger. The Russian army was totally out of date. The Romanovs had spent all of the money of the country on creating cathedrals, great show, these huge armies of wonderful uniforms and parades and so forth. But it was a vast army, but which was no good for warfare. I mean, it was so out of date, and especially in terms of artillery and all the rest of it, when the Germans were so much more powerful and so much more efficient. And this was going to be one of the reasons. And of course, it would create this anger and the bitterness, because it was always the peasantry which suffered in a war under the imperial regime.
And finally, then, do you think that this new reappraisal of Rasputin and what was happening this time will help shake the legend? Or do you think the legend has become so ingrained and so powerful that in some ways some people just prefer the legend?
Well, some people might. I mean, no, I'm amazed to see on the internet the whole time one seeing Boney M and sort of rah-rah Rasputin and lover of the Russian queen and all the rest of it. It seems to have got pretty deep into the popular imagination. But I'm not sure whether the book will be able to correct it or not. We will see. But it'll be very interesting to watch.
Very interesting to watch indeed. Well, it's a brilliant new book by Sir Anthony Beevor, Rasputin and the Downfall of the Romanovs. It's published in paperback and indeed hardback by Weidenfeld and Nicholson, and a superb new re-examination of this crucial period of Russian imperial history. Anthony, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
A great pleasure. Thanks so much.
We'll be continuing our discussion of Rasputin right after the break, where we'll be joined by Dr. Helen Rappaport. So stay with us here on News Talk. Welcome back. We're talking history, and tonight we are talking about the life and legend of Rasputin. And I'm joined now by Dr. Helen Rappaport, the internationally best-selling author, media consultant and historian who specialises in British and Russian history from 1837 to 1918. And her books include Caught in the Revolution, Petrograd, Russia 1917, A World on the Edge, as well as The Race to Save the Romanovs, The Truth Behind the Secret Plans to Rescue the Russian Imperial Family. Helen, you're very welcome.
Well, thank you for asking me.
It's incredible to see how sensationalized the story of Rasputin has become and how much legend has grown up around it. And very hard, as we saw in our chat with Anthony, to try and to separate the reality from the legend.
I get very weary with it all because, unfortunately, in the case of Rasputin, there is so much gossip, rumour, demonisation, damnation, you name it, of him as a person and as a practitioner of healing or whatever you want to call it. It's virtually impossible to separate truth from fiction with him. And I do feel in many ways he's one of the most demonised men in history, and to a certain extent unfairly so.
And why do you think people have been so quick to demonize him? Is it because rumor was so prevalent during his lifetime that it was all, there was so much myth even as he was alive, and it was contributing to the downfall of the monarchy that people were looking for things to believe, and they were happy to believe these stories?
Well, first of all, there was a massive concerted propaganda campaign against Rasputin, largely orchestrated by the Romanov family themselves, members of the aristocracy who despised him because they despised Alexandra the Tsaritsa and his influence over her. And the trouble is, you're in a war situation where that the kind of wild dissemination of gossip and rumour and scandal really was just got out of control because there were so many other things preoccupying the government. But essentially, I think he and Alexandra were the victims of a terrible campaign of vilification. I mean, you only have to look at these hideous sexual cartoons of them that appeared in some of the Russian gutter press to see the extent to which she was actually defamed, I think, in many respects, even though she actually deserved some of the criticism.
So let's talk about his relationship with the Romanovs then, how that relationship developed and why they became so dependent on him.
Well, it's a long story, but I would begin by saying if they had not had a haemophiliac son, Rasputin would never probably have got a foot in the door. The whole thing with Russia, I feel personally, can be boiled down and simplified to the fact that if Alexandra's son had not been haemophiliac, history in Russia might have been very different. But they didn't actually meet Rasputin till he'd already established himself in St. Petersburg in the 1900s as a sort of guru, faith healer, layer on a hands, whatever you want to call him. They were introduced to him by the wife of one of the Grand Dukes, Militsa. And this was in 1905, so they didn't meet him immediately. He'd been around for a while. And the important thing to remember with Rasputin, and it isn't said enough, because everyone jumps on the bandwagon of the sex and the drinking and this, that, and the other, is that their initial meeting with him was to talk to him about God, about religion. He, to them, initially, and in fact throughout, even after Alexei's crises, he was always a sort of wise guru, an advisor, a spiritual advisor particularly. They looked upon him as a kind of spiritual confidant. And it's in that sense that they first met him in 1905. A year later, they met him again. And then there was the first crisis in 1907, where Alexei, he came and prayed by Alexei's bed. And from then on, of course, as soon as Alexandra latched onto the fact, whether it was coincidence or not, that Rasputin could effect a calming of the bleeding episodes in her son, she clung to him through thick and thin to the bitter end.
And the relationship then seems to have hurt the Tsar and his wife in different ways. Nicholas was seen as weak, someone who was not in control of either the country or his family. There were rumours that Rasputin was having this sexual relationship and it was all blown up. And then Alexandra was then seen as this terrible woman who was betraying her husband, betraying the monarchy, betraying everything.
This is a dreadful, overworked cliché. I'm so sick and tired of it. Nicholas was weak. Alexandra was a vindictive, domineering harridan, controlling him, controlling everything. It's so cut and dried. It's so black and white. It was much more subtle than that. First of all, Nicholas was actually privately pretty sceptical about Rasputin. He kowtowed to his wife's desire to have Rasputin at the beck and call because, if it calmed her down that Rasputin came and said a few prayers over his son's bed, all well and good, because he once said quite openly, I'd rather have 10 Rasputins than one of her hysterical outfits, one of her hissy fits. So Nicholas, in a way, yes, he was weak, but he was not the totally ineffectual Tsar he's made out to be. There are many good, decent things about him. And I hate hearing him totally categorically dismissed in this way. But equally, Alexandra has been so written off as this dreadful hysteric. The trouble with Alexandra, of course, is that virtually no one knew the real woman. She never showed herself to the public. The people who knew the real woman, who could be loving and kind and loyal and look after her friends, maybe half a dozen people within her entourage. And that was the problem. The Russian people did not know that Tsaritsa, what she was really like. She didn't show herself to them.
And do you think Rasputin helped in terms of their son? And do you think that he did have some kind of healing power? Or was it the power of his will that convinced them? Or what was actually going on there?
Well, everyone, I think, through history has tried to analyze what it was he did. You know, did he hypnotize? Was he, in the religious sense, a healer who could miraculously make people well? There are one or two stories of people, you know, getting better after his sort of laying on of hands. I think the main thing with Rasputin was he had some kind of psychosomatic powers. He definitely did. Many people who disliked him said that he had an ability, particularly in the case of Alexei. It's this transference of a sense of calm. What he did, which was so clever, and I'm not saying that it was conniving of him, but what he did, he had this incredible, calm, deep, sonorous, Old Testament kind of manner. When Alexei was having one of his bleeding episodes, first of all, he would calm the mother. And that, importantly, then transferred to the child. And so he had what I would say is a kind of talking cure ability. It's a bit like horse whispering, actually. And there's a very interesting thing. I actually coined the phrase myself. I called him a people whisperer. Because what Rasputin did is exactly what the Russian peasants from Siberia and all over Russia learned. It was a skill with animals. Rasputin had this ability to calm people through speech and auto-suggestion. And in Siberia, it's something he'd learned as a peasant. His father was a horse trader. He dealt in horses. And when animals were injured, the peasants had this ability to calm the animal. And it was in Russian, it was zagovarivat krov, to talk to the blood, to calm the animal. And this, I think, is the gift that Rasputin had. It was almost a sort of visceral peasant gift. And it certainly worked with Alexandra, because when he calmed her and reassured her and said, don't worry, the little boy is not going to die, all will be well, you know, just pray, we will pray for him. She believed him. And that was the crucial thing. She believed him. It calmed her anxieties. That calm transferred to her boy. And that's the best way I can explain what he did.
There are so many similarities with the French Revolution and the way Marie Antoinette was demonized in the run-up to the monarchy being overthrown there, and eventually the king and queen being executed. And you see something similar happening in Russia as well. The targeting of Alexandra is a way of destabilizing the entire monarchy.
Well, she was, in a way, a scapegoat like Marie Antoinette. And incidentally, she had a portrait of Marie Antoinette, a large one on the wall at the Alexander Palace at Tsarskoye Sela. She has definitely, at times, been used as a whipping boy to blame the fall of Russia, the old regime, everything on her and her relationship with Rasputin. But it's like what I said at the beginning. I do believe if Alexei had been a normal, healthy boy and had not had haemophilia, a condition which at the time for which there was no treatment, no cure, and most kids would die in their teens, if that had not happened, I think things would have been very, very different in Russia.
And then, of course, the First World War changed everything as well, and the Tsar being so personally connected with the failures there and blamed for the failures, that undermined the Romanovs even more.
Well, he made the fatal mistake of becoming dissatisfied with his uncle, Grand Duke Nikolai, who was in command of the army at the Eastern Front, and deciding, what folly, to remove himself from Petrograd, as it then was during the war, and take himself, 400 miles to the front, to Army HQ at Stavka at Mogilyov, and sack his uncle and take over command of the army. So Nicholas, effectively, in 1915, when he did this, removed himself at a time when Russia was beginning to experience losses in the war, where morale was plummeting, where there were food shortages going on in the big cities, especially Petrograd, and where unrest was going. So it was growing. So he left the city, the capital, just as the trouble was brewing. And if he, again, this is not another big what if he had been in Petrograd and taken charge of the situation, things might have been very different. If also, if he had been at home, I mean, he might perhaps have taken more control over all the sackings and changes of ministers that Alexandra was doing, with Rasputin whispering in her ear. He definitely influenced her over the hiring and firing of some very unsuitable ministers. And indeed, they are to blame for that.
Given everything that was happening and everything that you describe, should Nicholas not just himself have intervened and either dismissed Rasputin or gone one step further and given the order for him to be killed, and that way reassert his dominance and his control and show the world and show the Russian people that he wasn't weak, that he was ruthless, that he was able to make these tough, ruthless decisions, and that way people wouldn't be in any doubt that he was the one in control?
But the trouble is, it wasn't all just about Rasputin. This is the thing, people pivoted all to being, oh, it's all about Rasputin. It's success or failure because Rasputin was there or wasn't there. The last thing on earth Nicholas would have done is to remove or let alone kill Rasputin. He knew his wife relied on him utterly emotionally, and also for the sake of the boy. To that extent, he would not, even if he was skeptical about Rasputin, he would not have risked removing the one man who seemed to be able to help the boy when he was having one of his serious hemorrhages. No, it was too far along the line by the time Nicholas realized what was going on. In fact, he never really was properly told what was going on. He was fed misinformation by ministers. He was in many ways kept in the dark about the state of affairs in the city back home.
Okay, well, tonight we are talking about the life and legend of Rasputin. We're going to take a quick break now, but when we come back, we'll be exploring his legacy as well as what happened to the Romanovs. So stay with us here on News Talk. Welcome back. We're talking history tonight. We are talking about Rasputin, and I'm delighted to be joined by the brilliant Dr. Helen Rappaport, the internationally best-selling author, media consultant and historian. She's an expert on British and Russian history, and her books include The Romanov Sisters, Caught in the Revolution, Petrograd, Russia 1917, A World on the Edge, as well as other books such as The Race to Save the Romanovs. And Helen, it's fascinating when we talk about Rasputin and we talk about his legend and how it was created in his lifetime and how it persisted after his death. It's extraordinary the way he is embedded in popular culture to such a degree, whether it is the Boney M song or whether it is TV programmes. I even remember recently an episode of Doctor Who where the Master was playing Rasputin in it, but that he is an instantly recognisable character. His story is known. He is known even by those who don't really know much about what was happening in Russia at this time because of the way the legend has been spread throughout the decades.
But that's just my point. The legend, the false story, the exaggerated story of Rasputin is what prevails, and people don't take enough time to try and explore all the nuances of his story and look at one or two of the positives about the man. He was not this mad, demonic monk. And it all goes back to one of those early films. I think it was 1928, the first silent film about Rasputin. The demonization started with the media as soon as film was available, the first film representations. You know, I think there's a Hammer horror with Rasputin, endlessly presented in TV series, films, you name it. And of course, that blinking Boney M song, I'm sorry, I mean, it's one of those songs, once they start playing, it sticks in your head and you can't get away from it. That's responsible in many ways for distorting the whole thing.
And yet, the version of Rasputin that we're talking about tonight and that you've presented is still a disturbing one. He's someone who is influencing Alexandra. He's influencing the appointment and the dismissal of people. He is a power behind the throne. He is involved in these decisions and does definitely seem to be exerting an influence and a power that he shouldn't have.
Well, you can say that, but the main reason Rasputin became such a powerful figure during the war was he abhorred the war. He was absolutely horrified when Nicholas declared war and took the Russians, against his better judgment, into war. He had a real Old Testament prophetic attitude to war, that it would be the end of Russia. And he famously actually said to Nicholas and Alexandra, I don't know if it's apocryphal, but at some point he said to them, all the time I'm alive, your throne is safe. And of course he was right. He was a man of the people, in the great Russian tradition of the wise mujik, the wise peasant. And he basically was a pacifist. He wanted Russia to get out of the war. And that brings us to the main reason why there might have been Allied connivance in his removal, because you had a lot of members of the Allied forces based, you know, senior military based in St. Petersburg, Petrograd during the war, and they were all horrified because Rasputin kept going on about, you know, he wanted Russia out of the war, he wanted Nicholas to make peace and end the fighting and the killing. And the last thing the Allies wanted, particularly the Brits, was Russia to pull out the Eastern Front. So, you know, there was a lot of political reasons in the background, foreign influence, that was very happy to see him murdered and removed from that kind of stranglehold of influence, as they saw it, over the Tsaritsa.
And it is one of the great ironies of the story of Rasputin that the person who was a monarchist and who was a supporter of the system and who did, as you say, see the dangers of that war effort, that he became seen as the symbol of the rot and what was wrong, and that he was someone who helped speed up the downfall of the monarchy.
Well, I think the rot had been a long time coming. I mean, the rot had been coming really since the 1880s and then the 90s as the revolutionary movement grew. Rasputin has come to falsely and unfairly embody everything that was wrong and rotten about Russia. And I don't think that is entirely fair, actually. It's like I say, I think he's one of the most demonized figures, in not just in Russian history, but in 19th century history. And it's too simplistic to sum it up that way and say, oh, the Russian throne fell because of Rasputin. Well, I would say, actually, the Russian throne probably fell because Alexei was a haemophiliac. That opened the door to Rasputin, which is not quite the same thing. Because before Rasputin came along, Alexandra had been consulting with every quack and seer and mystic and faith healer she could find. There was a Frenchman called Monsieur Philippe, who had a bit of a hold over her for a couple of years, who was an outright quack. I don't think Rasputin was a quack. He was cunning, he was clever, he was seductive, he could be quite devious, but he also had this incredible kind of power of prophecy. And I don't think you can take that away from him.
As you show in your book, The Race to Save the Romanovs, the Russian imperial family was murdered. They were gunned down 18 and a half months after the death of Rasputin. And I wonder, what do you think went so badly wrong in that 18 and a half month period? Was it the war? Was it this cycle of events that just made it impossible for them to survive? Or was there a way out of the disaster that was unfolding before them?
Are you talking about specifically the fate of the Romanovs?
I suppose maybe the two elements. First, the downfall of the monarchy, and then the fact, as you show in the book, how difficult it was for the allied governments to save the families in themselves as well.
Well, the monarchy was rotten to the core, as I just said. It's so difficult to say what would or could have happened. Probably eventually, Nicholas would have been browbeaten into more sort of token forms of constitutional government. I mean, he was in 1904 with the introduction of the Dumas, but I think he would have been bullied into making concessions. The problem was his wife. His wife was resistant to any erosion of the powers of the autocracy, and it was that resistance to change and reform and moving Russia on into a constitutional model like Britain that was really the cause of their downfall. But in terms of them getting out, they were marked. The minute the revolution came in Petrograd, end of February 1917, they were very quickly trapped. Within days, Nicholas abdicated and came back from the front under house arrest with his family. Now, there are so many books and arguments and articles and interviews I've seen, and that's why I wrote that particular book, that say it was all because George V said no and the Brits could have saved them. It's a fantasy, and I wish people would listen to me. I wish more people would read that book, because there is absolutely no way that anyone could have got the Romanovs out of Russia after the revolution. Within 2 weeks, the Bolsheviks, the hardliners, the revolutionaries had control of all the railways. You can't take them directly east because there's a war. They can't go east through war-torn Europe. You can't get them south because the peasants are burning the estates and there are revolutionaries everywhere down south to take them to Crimea. The only fantasy there was, and it is a fantasy, was to get them out to the north coast of Russia, to Murmansk, when the ice melted enough to allow it for a British destroyer or warship to go in, pick them up and take them back to England. But how are you going to get a family of seven on a train in the middle of a revolution, even out of Petrograd? I mean, I've looked at the sources. I've examined all the possibilities. Geographically, it was impossible to get them out on a train. Any train trying to leave the station at Tsarskoye Selo would not have got very far before being stopped by the revolutionaries. Nicholas and Alexander would have been hauled off and lynched. There's just no way the family could have been got out. And then it gets even more bizarre when later in the story they're moved to Siberia. And there are all these half-baked plots by revolutionaries who think they can go charging in and lift them from the heavily guarded house. The whole thing has been accepted for too long as all being down to King George saying, no, they can't come here, because he had a wobbly and got scared. And it's much more complicated than that.
Helen, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
You're welcome. Thank you.
A brilliant discussion on the life, legacy and legend of Rasputin. Earlier in the show, we were joined by Sir Anthony Beaver, the acclaimed historian and writer, whose new book, Rasputin and the Downfall of the Romanovs, is available in paperback and hardback, published by Weidenfeld and Nicholson. And also our thanks to Dr. Helen Rappaport, the internationally best-selling author, media consultant and historian. Well, that does bring us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to my producer, Marisa Sullivan, for bringing everything together. We hope you can join us next week for more debate and discussion. We've been talking history. Good night.